So we're going to move on now and talk about the first clinical state that we wanted to get into, which is so-called M0 disease. And just to get started with that, Rob, can you talk about what the typical scenario is that we diagnose a man with M0 disease and how it's usually initially evaluated and managed?
Sure. And this is an evolution. So M0 disease just simply refers to a rising PSA. So primary therapy, surgery. If you remove a man's prostate, you should not really be able to detect a PSA. So rising PSA after prostatectomy, assuming it nadired, is a PSA failure. Patients who undergo radiotherapy have a prostate in place. And remember, PSA is prostate-specific antigen. It's not a cancer marker. It's a prostate marker. And there are formulas to suggest PSA rise after radiotherapy. That's the most common scenario. Depending on the state of the patient, how far out, the initial diagnosis, some men will undergo imaging. Conventionally, that's a bone scan and CT scan of abdomen and pelvis. Increasingly, around the world and eventually here in the U.S., it's going to be sort of what we call next-generation imaging with probably a PSMA PET. That's not really available other than a research tool now, but will be later. So that's an evolutionary change.
So, Matthew, I guess one issue that comes up when you see a man who's had local therapy, whether it's surgery or radiation therapy, sometimes if they've had a prostatectomy on the hope that there might be a local recurrence, even if you can't see it, they might get radiation therapy. The patients then may then have further progression with their PSA. Can you talk a little bit, Matthew, because not every single man who has a PSA recurrence requires treatment. Can you talk about how that's decided, whether the patient can be observed or actually needs to be treated?
Sure. So I really like that earlier slide that showed the balance, patient, I think, holding the balance, because that's what our job really is, to help patients weigh their decisions. And in order for them to do that, they need to have reliable information about the benefits and the harms. But the part that they have to help us do is to acknowledge their preferences for care, because they're going to assign different values to those different factors. So provided they have reliable information about what those factors should be, they can then help us make that decision on their behalf or with them, the ultimate shared decision. And in really every patient decision that isn't, high category one level evidence, I'm generally, focusing on patient preferences for care and deciding that in this case, it's really not whether they're ever going to receive ADT, but when, because you can either give it to them sooner or you can wait and for months or years until they develop metastatic disease in some cases and then treat them later. So a lot of times it's like looking in the mirror, because it's really what the patient is telling you what they want. And I have to say, this is made much more difficult in virtual care, because we rely on a lot of, verbal and nonverbal cues to understand patient preference. And I have to say, with Zoom, it's a bit more challenging to understand those things. And there have been settings where we've just simply said, we need to follow up this Zoom meeting with a face-to-face visit to better understand how we're going to get to this decision.
One of the things I've seen over the years, and it's also in the literature, Matthew, in terms of trying to decide whether or not the patient should be treated or maybe could be observed, is the so-called PSA doubling time, Matthew. Can you explain what that is, how it's calculated, and how it affects what's being done?
Yeah, absolutely. So PSA doubling time, which is a reflection of rate of PSA rise, is a strong predictor of clinical outcomes, time to development of metastatic disease, and in some studies, survival. And it's calculated by putting multiple PSA values over time into a calculator. There are online calculators that are available. If you're facile at doing it, you can make your own Excel spreadsheet to do it, however you like. Easier to do by just Googling PSA doubling time calculator and put the values in. There's one, Memorial Sloan Kettering has a PSA doubling time calculator online as well. But quite easy, you put in the dates and the PSA values and it spits out a number. If we look at all men with a rising PSA after prior surgery or radiation, the median PSA doubling time is about 10 or 12 months. So that gives you a landmark for what the average is. And so a patient whose doubling time is 2 years would be viewed as, you know, having particularly indolent disease. A patient with a doubling time of 3, 4, 5, 6 months would be viewed as having more aggressive disease and probably a better candidate for early intervention.
And, you know, as we were talking about before, if you're talking about an 85 or 90-year-old man with comorbidities who statistically might have a limited life expectancy with a doubling time of 2 years, that patient might end up being observed. We're going to go to a case in a second, but before we do get to the case, Kara, just one other question about PSA. The so-called, I've heard the term used, PSA anxiety. Mm. And again, I think somewhat unique to prostate cancer is the fixation that maybe the healthcare team has as well on PSA value. Any comments on that, Kara?
Yeah, that's another great question. And I think really relevant now as so many practices and so many hospitals, we have these patient gateways or patient portals where patients are able to log in and actually look at their PSA values sometimes before they see us, if they've had their labs done prior to our visits. And sometimes they've created a fatal idea about what that number means, and then it increases their anxiety as they come into our visit. So I really always tell patients, we use your PSA as a part of your whole picture. So what drives our decision making is always first and foremost how you feel. So going back to what their priorities are, how they are tolerating treatment so far. We also factor in things, as we've mentioned, CAT scans and bone scans as we make decisions. So I always tell patients for their language and their sort of mindset, we use it as a signal to help guide us and a part of the whole picture. So I always say, if you're having anxiety about a lab you've seen before you come in, or you're really worried, you can call us and we can talk about how to manage that anxiety before you come in is one strategy. And then I always say, you never have to make a decision that day. You know, Matthew always says we make recommendations, and as a patient and a family, you make decisions. And so we're here to guide you through that and don't have to make those decisions in the immediate moment.
Wow, I like that one. That's really good.
Yeah,
recommendations versus decisions. That's a good one. So let's see how this plays out in terms of a case. And now we're going to also start to get in to other forms of hormonal therapy in addition to androgen deprivation and how to separate those out, particularly the anti-androgens that are so important in this M0 situation and the differences between them. This case here of Vicky's being very interesting. This patient has M0 disease, which required treatment, but actually got one anti-androgen, enzalutamide, and had problems with that, and then did well on a different one, darolutamide. Maybe just focusing on what happened, Vicky, with this man when he got these two different therapies.
Yes, so this is a gentleman who actually ended up getting enzalutamide. And again, when you're thinking of PO drugs, a lot of the patients will think, okay, no sweat, this is really good. But we did explain that one of the major side effects was fatigue. And they could also get diarrhea, some nausea and vomiting, but not everybody gets it. But he was very happy to get another drug, and the drug that he did take was enzalutamide. The unfortunate thing is that he was one of the patients that suffered significant side effects from enzalutamide, and actually, even though we reduced the dose, he continued to have these side effects, and his treatment was ultimately discontinued. It was based on his decision to stop treatment because his overall quality of life was so bad that he said he would rather not have treatment than continuing on this, even if it meant that his disease would progress. But the lucky thing for him was that his disease stayed stable while he was on his LHRH analog, so he did well with continued close monitoring. The unfortunate thing is that more recently, his PSA started to rise. The PSA doubling time was calculated to be less than 7 months, and his scans on conventional scanning were negative, and we suggested that he actually consider another treatment. Darolutamide is one of the most recent drugs FDA approved with the least amount of side effects for patients with his stage of disease, and he opted to try it, and he said, well, if it doesn't work or if I have a lot of side effects, I'll discontinue it. He's still on it and he's doing well with it. So we're happy about that. And again, it's patient decision and he's very happy. His PSA is coming down and he says it's like taking nothing, but he could have been one of the patients that actually had side effects.
So again, you know, we'll see in another case a patient who did well on enzalutamide. This is a common story in oncology. Some people do well in one, some people do well in others. Fortunately, in many parts of oncology, we have multiple agents available. I was thinking about CDK inhibitors in breast cancer, PARP inhibitors, but we also have multiple anti-androgens. And Matthew, maybe you can review what the what an anti-androgen is, how it works, and what we know, and there are now three anti-androgens approved in this situation, what we know in terms of how they differ.
So anti-androgens block the androgen receptor. They bind the ligand binding domain of the androgen receptor and block activation through that pathway. We have three FDA-approved anti-androgens in non-metastatic CRPC, apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide. To date, there's no head-to-head trials between the agents, but certainly Vicky provided a compelling example for a patient who did much better with one than the other, so I support the care that he received. All three studies have shown compelling efficacy with major improvements in metastasis-free survival, meaning delay in development of detectable metastatic disease, and most importantly, at this year's ASCO update, all three studies now are reporting an overall survival benefit. So to the naysayers out there who were, you know, skeptical about intervening in this setting, we now have level one evidence for improved overall survival for all three drugs, which I think speaks to the importance of both the disease state and the opportunity to intervene in appropriate patients. We do lack head-to-head comparisons between the drugs, but when we look between the trials, as you heard from Vicky, darolutamide appears to be the best tolerated with somewhat less fatigue and no excess risk for falls or fractures in contrast to the other agents. And many patients we've treated both on and off studies, now that it's FDA approved, will report similar things, which is saying they really can't tell that they're taking any medication. For fairness with the other agents, though, if you look at rates of treatment discontinuation due to side effects, the rates were quite low across all three trials and similar between the trials. So in advance, it's hard to, most patients are going to do fine with any of the agents, but there certainly are some patients who will not do well with APA or ENZA and may benefit from the switch to darolutamide. And it's also that better tolerability that has led us to use it preferentially in many patients, particularly those who are at greater risk for side effects.
And we'll talk a little bit about the type of side effects that occur not only in the M0 situation, but also with metastatic disease where these agents are commonly used. But just in terms of the M0 situation, Rob, you know, when you look at these three agents and these three trials that study the agents, you see they all seem to have similar benefits. In terms of reducing the risk of progression and death, but also that, you know, the control arm, the people who just stayed on an LHRH agonist, which is what we would have done maybe a few years ago, do not do very well. Any comments on the benefit that is seen in this situation, Rob, and whether you think there's any difference in terms of efficacy with the three?
Well, as Dr. Smith pointed out, now that we have overall survival benefit from all three, I mean, the data is incredibly compelling. So I don't think there's any argument about the data. I would remind folks that the trials enrolled patients with PSA doubling times less than 10 months. The FDA label for all three drugs is silent on PSA doubling time. There are certainly patients who probably never needed hormonal therapy in the first place, who eventually developed castrate biochemical disease, with prolonged PSA doubling times, you probably don't need these drugs. So we have to be a little careful. Like my colleagues, I think that if you look at the trials, the toxicity profile in the darolutamide study in the placebo arm did seem to be significantly better. Like Dr. Smith, I've had an opportunity to work with that compound before it had a name. And I also think that probably it has a somewhat better safety profile. So I think the bottom line is the three drugs are equivalent in terms of activity, and the distinction may be the side effect profile.
And, you know, some of the side effects, Kara, to me seem like a little subtle. You know, patients might call it fatigue, but maybe it's a little bit beyond that. There's been a discussion about whether this is really a CNS effect. Any comments on some of the kind of clinical observations you've made, Kara, with men who are receiving anti-androgens in terms of the tolerability issues that you see?
Sure. So I think everyone's really nicely commented on, you know, that there is this science that talks about really, you know, these new drugs that we have and how effective they are. But the art of it is really tailoring it to each individual. And yes, I think each of them causes some level of fatigue, and that varies from patient to patient. And a lot of patients say, I feel like I'm forgetful. If there are four things on my list to do, by the time I get to the fourth, I can't quite pull up the fourth. And so I often say the physical fatigue that you feel can often manifest in mental fatigue or CNS fatigue. So it's harder to measure. You can measure it physically. If you're someone who walks 3 or 4 miles a day, you do less of that as you get further into treatment sometimes, but we can't measure our CNS fatigue the same way. So I try and use that as a relatable tool for patients. If you're feeling like you're doing a little bit less physically, it may feel the same way cognitively.
And so just to go back to this slide here, comparing in these different trials, the tolerability issues, Matthew, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more in terms of the way you interpret this, in terms of, for example, why you see fewer falls and fractures, and how maybe this would ties actually into a CNS effect of these drugs.
Yeah, so I don't think it's yet been explicitly stated, but darolutamide was designed not to cross the blood-brain barrier, and so it has lower CNS penetration, and that does distinguish it in non-clinical models from apalutamide and enzalutamide. So the predicted benefit of that would be that you'd have less CNS side effects, including things like seizures, fatigue, and potentially falls and fractures. So the observation that we actually see less fatigue when you compare placebo to drug for Daro compared to the other agents, and you see really no excess risk of falls or fractures in contrast to the other drugs, leads me to conclude that this is, or at least provisionally conclude, that this is probably reflecting the benefit that the drug does not cross the blood-brain barrier.